From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a big
In Syria, rebel-held eastern Aleppo is falling, with grisly reports of civilians being slaughtered in the process. Donald Trump's pick to lead the State Department is encountering skepticism from Senate Republicans, and Trump still says he isn't sure Russia meddled in the election. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor of Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Jill Filipovich, lawyer, journalist, and author of the forthcoming book, The H-Spot, The Feminist Pursuit of Happiness. David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic, is our special guest. Welcome, everybody. The evacuation of eastern Aleppo has stopped. About 8,000 people were allowed to leave the rebel-held area of what was once Syria's largest city under a deal brokered by Turkey and Russia. But the deal is broken down, with the rebel and government sides blaming each other. About 500,000 people have died so far in the years-long civil war between the Syrian government, backed by Russia and Iran, and rebel groups supported by the United States, Turkey, and Persian Gulf countries. The fear had been gruesome reprisals if the government managed to take control of all of Aleppo, and indeed, there are reports of summary executions of civilians. Secretary of State John Kerry called it nothing short of a massacre. President-elect Trump, speaking at a rally, called for the creation of safe zones to protect Syrian civilians within Syria, funded by Gulf governments and administered in some way by the United States. Is that a viable option?
Well, I think we're so far down the road here that options are very limited, and it's worth underlining just the incredible tragedy this is. You know, Syria has been misgoverned and governed by a dictatorship for decades and decades, but several years ago was a dusty, backwards, but, you know, a livable second world country, and now it's been basically destroyed. And I've played around with that idea myself of safe havens. It's just any intervention of that nature, you really end up owning much more than you expect you will. And I'd be really hesitant to do it. And if I were going to do things to try to alleviate the plight of the refugees, I would do it by supporting the efforts in neighboring countries.
Jill, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I don't think the U.S. has a lot of good options here. You have Sam Power, who's kind of just screaming into the ether on this one. And the Obama administration seems to have kind of cut her out of serious decision-making a long time ago.
This is the U.S. Ambassador to the U.N.?
Yes. Sorry. Yes. Sorry. Yeah, Samantha Power. You know, she's been urging the no-fly zone, but are we really going to be shooting a Russian airplane out of the sky over Syria? Probably not. And the American people certainly, I think, don't have much of an appetite to involve ourselves in yet another country. You know, I think Trump's proposal, it's like Rich said, it's something that a lot of people have sort of tossed out there. I think embroiling ourselves even deeper in that part of the world, I'm not sure is going to be a winning strategy. I do think we need to obviously open our doors to more refugees. We need to be able to assist European countries who are bearing the brunt of this mass exodus from Syria. We should be supporting humanitarian missions in Syria to make sure that people are able to access medical care and exit where they can. And we should frankly be putting much more pressure on Russia and Iran, who are the ones that are underwriting this entire massacre.
David, what do you see as the way forward?
People who study civil wars report that they very rarely end through brokered compromises. They usually end because somebody wins. So the dilemma for a great power like the United States with wide but limited interests is if there isn't somebody you want to see win, it's very hard to know how you're going to bring a war to an end. There was nobody in Syria whom we would like to see win to it, who had any real hope of winning. All the likely winners are people we didn't like to a greater or lesser degree. So I don't think that the United States did wrong to keep out of Syria. And I think the project now has to be to limit the damage, both to the unfortunate human casualties of the war and also to our allies. I mean, the Syrian exodus into Europe has been a very dangerous thing for Europe, and a very dangerous because it has done so much to strengthen radical xenophobic illiberal movements in Europe. It has become a threat to NATO. If that refugee exodus had not happened, I don't think Marine Le Pen would be doing so well in France, and I think Britain might not have left the European Union.
So Is David right then that basically this is a terrible thing that we couldn't have done much about? I look at sort of the three models of U.S. intervention in the Middle East and North Africa when you have awful internal disputes. You had Iraq, where we invaded and deposed an awful, brutal dictator and installed a government that we thought would be better, and the result was a huge, awful mess. And then you had Libya, where we supported from the air a rebel campaign that toppled a horrible, oppressive, awful dictator. But we didn't go in on the ground. We didn't manage the reconstruction. And the result was a huge, awful mess. And then you have Syria, where we were relatively hands-off, and it ended up in a huge, awful mess. And so none of those three strategies seems to have proved itself out as something that looks really appealing.
Correct. I do think Iraq may, at the end of the day, we still don't know how the story of Iraq ends, is going to look much better than Syria, and actually may end up a somewhat decently governed country for that part of the world. But the cost and blood and treasure for the United States was enormous. I think David is right that a lot of civil wars end by just sheer exhaustion and one side grinding down the other. But there are other models. You know, the wars in the Balkans, you did have a more brokered peace, at least for a while. And that's what I would have gone for at the beginning in Syria. I would have done more to back the so-called moderate rebels, at the same time having some doubts about how actually moderate they were and whether that even would have made a difference. But I do think that the passivity here, the red line that was then ignored, and then effectively welcoming the Russians into Syria, and the Russian counterinsurgency strategy is rubble, you know, it's what you've seen in Aleppo, was a mistake. I just don't have great confidence that doing more would have definitely created a better result.
Yeah, I mean, people point to the Balkans as the example of where interventions into civil wars end up working out relatively well. I just wonder about the replicability of that. I mean, one of the things you had there was that you could offer up EU membership as sort of a reward for becoming stable and normal in the Balkans. Now, obviously, that's not something you're going to hand out in Syria. I don't think the level of influence that Europe had in the former Yugoslavia can be replicated in these places.
I think that's exactly right. You know, there's just sort of not much of a carrot that you can really offer many of the parties in Syria that's going to seem relevant and big enough to get this war to end. You know, I'm very worried for what happens under a Trump presidency, and I know we're talking about Russia later in the program. You know, but you have an administration that is so far has seemed very sympathetic to Russian positions across a variety of issues. I mean, you look at Russia's role in Syria. I mean, it's been devastating. It's been horrific. And to think that we may now have a U.S. president that sides potentially with Russia, or that is simply unwilling to put the kind of public pressure and shaming on the Russian interventions in Syria that, frankly, the country needs to experience, I think we're headed for much worse devastation.
What's the alternative as this regards Europe? I mean, if there is nothing that we can productively do, or that we could have productively done to prevent this situation in Syria, there would have been at least the attempt at the refugee influx. Now, I guess you could have had a much more brutal policy within Europe trying to keep people out. But not only would that have had its own attendant problems, it also would not have been fully effective. So what, you know, David, what could have been done to prevent this situation from destabilizing Europe? Wasn't this inherently a very destabilizing thing that happened beyond Syria?
You write a big check to Syria's neighbors to house refugees closer to the place of origin. It's much cheaper to do that, by the way, than to bring them into Europe, and much both in absolute monetary terms and politically. In a way, that's how the refugee crisis is being settled. Europe is paying Turkey. They're just paying them now not only with money, but with a lot of political concessions, allowing the authoritarian president of Turkey, Erdogan, to consolidate his power. That's part of the deal. Every time Europe makes some noise complaining about some atrocious thing he's done, he threatens to release a big new bunch of refugees into Europe. Pay the Jordanians, pay the Turks. But resettling this population in Europe is bad in all kinds of ways. They You know, the people have this. The first people to come out of a situation like this are the best educated, the most affluent, the most mobile. But as things get worse, as the exodus is numbered not in the thousands or the tens of thousands, but the hundreds of thousands and the millions, you meet most of the Syrian population, where most people have very limited formal education, where illiteracy is very high, and they are just not going to be able to find work for themselves in an advanced country in Europe. You know, the median private sector wage in Germany, something like 30 euros an hour. Not the wage, sorry, the cost to employ somebody. If somebody doesn't have skills worth 30 euros an hour, they're not going to be employed. And big categories of jobs that in the United States employ casual labor don't exist over there. They don't have parking lot attendants. They don't have dishwashers. They automate those jobs, or they have more specialized people do them.
Jill, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure why there's not more. I agree, of course, yes, you know, help fund the large refugee camps that already exist in Jordan. You know, I think Turkey is a slightly, obviously, a sort of complicated matter given their leadership. You know, but I would like to see more of a push for the U.S. to actually open our own doors. And I realize that there's an argument that that is politically unpopular and that could lead to the rise of more far-right figures like Trump. But I really do believe we have a moral imperative here. Europe has taken on the brunt of this crisis. And yes, I think David's right that that's been a contributing factor to the rise of these right-wing movements. But, and I don't know, maybe this is just my, like, liberalism talking, but I think at some point you do have a basic obligation to other human beings to help, and you have certainly have an international, legal obligation to help people that show up on your shores. And I think the U.S., yes, giving money is great. Yes, you know, making some strategic decisions for how to help manage this war is great and important and necessary. But at the end of the day, people need to not starve and die, and they need to have a roof over their heads. And the U.S. has taken far, obviously, far fewer refugees than most countries in Western Europe. And I think it's our turn to step up to the plate and say, we're going to let folks in, we're going to help get them employed, we're going to put roofs over their heads, and we're going to respond in a humane way to this massive and horrific crisis.
That's sort of the opposite of what Donald Trump promised to do. And I think he thinks that his promise not to accept Syrian refugees was one of the more popular things he proposed that was a reason behind his victory. And I think he's probably right about that, that it was one of his more popular policy positions. So I think it's very unlikely that the U.S. will do anything like that.
They're not going to. Yeah. I don't think they will either. But in terms of, you know, people, not necessarily Donald Trump, but in terms of people like me or you or anyone who has a platform, I do think we should all be shouting about this, and that this is a humanitarian disaster. And you look at those photos and you put yourself in the shoes of somebody who's in Syria, and it's very hard when you think about it that way to say, okay, well, we need to contain these folks because they might lead to the right, you know, the rise of ultra-right nationalism. That may be true, but the immediate human impact is so disastrous that I do think that anyone who has kind of a humane bone in their body really has to be pushing for at least a tiny bit of movement on this stuff.
Rich, what do you think about that?
I disagree. I think if you run the numbers for how costly it is to do refugee resettlement here, it can actually help many people over in neighboring countries. And the fact is, with the United States and Europe, these refugees, they aren't coming directly from, you know, being bombed in Aleppo. They're coming from someplace that's safe. It might not be great accommodations, it might not be a long-term solution, but they're not, the choice isn't admitting them into the U.S. or they die in Aleppo. It's admitting them in the U.S. or they're staying in Turkey or Jordan. And I just think politically and financially, it makes more sense for us to do what we can to help those countries who are on the front lines and are going to absorb many millions more of these people than we can. We can double the amount of Syrian refugees that we're taking. It will still just be a drop in the bucket.
Well, let us know what you think about the situation in Syria at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, Russia and the United States. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Jill Filipovich. She's a journalist and author of the forthcoming book, The H-Spot, The Feminist Pursuit of Happiness. And David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic, is also with us. Donald Trump has named Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson to be Secretary of State, and this pick is hitting some headwinds from Senate Republicans whose votes will be needed to confirm him into that position. Marco Rubio, Lindsey Graham, and John McCain have expressed concerns about Tillerson's reputedly close relationship with Vladimir Putin and about Tillerson's opposition to sanctions on Russia, expressed in his capacity as CEO of an oil company with extensive business interests in Russia. These concerns have taken on added urgency with the continuing reports that are emerging about Russia's role in hacking and releasing information from democratic organizations in an effort to influence the election. Rubio sits on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and if all Democrats on the committee voted against the pick, his single vote could block Tillerson from even getting to the floor. If he then gets to the floor, only three Republican defections could cause his nomination to be defeated. In that environment, a lot of support has been coming actually out of Bush world, pushing in favor of Tillerson's confirmation. Robert Gates and Condoleezza Rice have been calling around to skeptical Republicans, vouching for Tillerson and urging his confirmation. Though I should note, Gates and Rice run a firm that does business with Exxon, which is how they know Tillerson in the first place. Rich, what do you make of this pick? Is this too soft on Russia, and is this a pick that you think Trump will be able to get through the Senate?
Well, I think any CEO at this level is by definition a hugely impressive and capable person, which I'm sure Rex Tillerson is. I imagine he'll do very well in these one-on-one meetings with senators, because also CEOs at this level, they're basically politicians as well. But his views on foreign policy are a blank slate beyond what he did in his capacity at ExxonMobil to maximize shareholder value. And he had extensive dealings with Russia up to and including accepting a medal from Vladimir Putin. So I think that the vetting will be robust. The confirmation hearings will be important, but I'd still be kind of surprised if he went down.
David, what do you think?
I would say the answer to your questions are yes and yes. Yes, he is too close to Russia, and yes, he will get through the Senate. There is a lot of talk right now about resistance. I expect that Lindsey Graham and John McCain will remain robust. I don't expect very many others to, and I don't think they will find that all-important third vote. The problem with the Russia story from a Republican Party point of view is, in a way, it's too horrible to deal with. If it were less bad, it could somehow be quarantined and you could go on. But even what we know is already so terrible that a hostile foreign state intervened in an American election, that there is video, we all saw it, of the Republican nominee welcoming and encouraging that intervention, and it turned out to be quite probably decisive. That's such a bad story that I don't know how Republicans work their way around it. And then the administration is now filling up with appointees who are very sympathetic to Russian points of view on all kinds of questions, not just Syria, but also Ukraine, also the exit of Britain from the European Union. Every American president from Gerald Ford onward has wanted Britain in because a strong Europe is in America's interest. Donald Trump took the Russian point of view of wanting Britain out. And his White House keeps company with some of the most dangerous and disturbing actors inside the European Union, like the French National Front and others.
Jill, I've been watching the reaction of liberals and Democrats as this Russia story has sort of gotten worse and worse. And you've had some Democratic electors seeking an intelligence briefing of their own before the Electoral College meets. And a lot of it seems to be hinting around this idea that the Electoral College should refuse to elect Donald Trump on the grounds of this interference. But nobody seems to want to quite say that out loud, even though it's like that seems like the only reason it would be relevant for the electors to get a briefing is if they are deciding whether, in fact, they should vote for Trump as they are scheduled to do. And this looks to me like a really big mistake from the left, that like if we're worried about the undermining of democratic institutions, the last thing we should be trying to do is sort of set aside the result of an election, that even though the Russians did this nefarious and illegal thing, it was ultimately American voters who went into those voting booths and chose Donald Trump in sufficient numbers such that he won. What do you make of this reaction?
Well, I mean, I do think it's time that we really reconsidered whether we have an electoral college and the fact that Democrats failed to do that failed to even address that issue after the election, first election of George W. Bush, I think sort of speaks volumes about the problems with the party's priorities and their organizing structure. That said, you know, I'm sort of two minds on this. I do believe that Donald Trump is a different kind of candidate. I don't know how you let the results of an election stand if we did have a hostile foreign power that interfered in it. On the other hand, I do think you're right that if we start undermining the very institutions that we say we're trying to preserve, I think the backlash from the right is going to be immense. So, you know, I sort of, at the end of the day, would come down on sort of your same side, which is that I actually think it would be quite detrimental for the Electoral College to just decide kind of single-handedly we're not going to make this man president. You know, but I really think keeping this laser focus on the fact that Trump is very clearly setting up a kleptocracy cabinet. That's what's going on. He is creating mechanisms for himself to be enriched, for his friends to gain significant amounts of wealth. I do not fundamentally do not believe that he's acting in the best interest of the United States. These are all scary, unprecedented, very, very abnormal things. And for activists and for journalists and even for, you know, people in elected office, Republicans, I think there's a moral obligation to keep hammering this point and, you know, to maintain that this is not normal. We do need investigations into what's especially what happened with Russian interference in the elections. And that this isn't necessarily a partisan issue. This is very much an issue of, you know, basic loyalty to your country.
I think the hacking, it was obviously appalling. It obviously should be investigated. And this is something where Congress actually has the independent power to conduct hearings and a serious investigation without relying on the Trump administration. But I do think so the election was so narrow, anything could have made a difference. But this was litigated prior to the election. It's not as though that no one was aware that the Russians were attempting to intervene in this way. Every time the Clinton campaign was asked about WikiLeaks, this is what they said. They basically refused to address any of the substantive revelations in WikiLeaks because they just said, we're not going to talk about it because Russia did it. It came up twice in debates. And the idea that if we had just talked about this more, you know, Hillary would have gotten, say, those 77,000 votes in Detroit that she didn't, that Obama got in 2012 is really hard to believe. And a lot of the actual WikiLeaks revelations were just of gossipy, you know, Neera Tanden said this about David Brock, who cares? There were a few that were really damaging, like the Doug Band memo, but that wasn't a fabrication. That was a fact. It just reinforced what we already knew about the Clinton Foundation being a profit center for all these people. So the idea that the election itself is fundamentally tainted or would have turned out differently, or we need some version of a rerun, I just don't get.
This isn't about fairness to Hillary Clinton. And by the way, the election was not close. The Electoral College was. She won by 2.7 million votes. Trump got about a third of a point more than Michael Dukakis. This isn't about fairness to Hillary Clinton or fairness to Democrats. This is about a hostile foreign power being this is about the realization of the most feverish nightmare of the Founding Fathers, intrigues by an autocratic foreign power to install their creature, as Alexander Hamilton called him, in the presidency of the United States. We have a situation where we have a security risk in the Oval Office. Just an unimaginable thing. Somebody who is beholden to a hostile foreign power. This is not just a question about what was in WikiLeaks. This is here's some other questions. How beholden does Donald Trump feel? How the ability of the Russians to embarrass him by releasing more information about what they've done to make it very clear that yeah, we did it. We're proud of it. Thank you, Donald. We love you, Donald. You're our guy. This is a very, very dangerous situation. Rich is right. It needs to be investigated. The Electoral College is the wrong way to deal with this. That will only precipitate that in itself is a kind of revolution and unacceptable. There are other prophylactics that we're going to need. But first, we need to get to the bottom of it, including with this question. We know that the Russians communicated with America. Did anybody in the Trump campaign communicate back to the Russians? Mm-hmm.
Well, but so it seems to me the problems you're describing there, David, the correct check on this is in Congress, that if Donald Trump does the things that you're describing that he might do, some of which sound like they would be treasonous, you could impeach him. Now, the question of whether Republicans in the House of Representatives will effectively police Donald Trump there is, I think, an open one and not one where I'm very enthusiastic about the likely answer to the open question. But that's where that power is vested in the Constitution to guard against a president who, you know, criminally acts against the country.
All this, they're political questions. So prior to the campaign, the election, voters had the choice. Are you going to vote for Hillary Clinton because she's been hacked? You know, her campaign manager has been hacked by the Russians. Or are you going to take more seriously the information that's revealed through that stolen information? And apparently, I mean, we don't know what the answer is, but apparently more people took the information on board rather than being appalled by the Russians. And whatever Donald Trump's Russia policy is going to be, it'll be up to the public to decide whether they're appalled by it or whether it constitutes treason. And I think we're getting very far down a speculative rabbit hole to talk about Donald Trump committing treason. And just let's see. You know, he is the third president now who's come into office. This is an American tradition, believing he has the magical key to better relations with Vladimir Putin. Now, I think progressively that that belief has been stupider and more, maybe in Trump's case, insidious, because we have more information about what Vladimir Putin is. But he is talking about pursuing a version of reset that half our political class thought was a wonderful idea when Barack Obama did it. And not until, you know, about 2 months ago have Democrats suddenly decided that Vladimir Putin is this horrible, thuggish figure. I mean, Obama welcomed him into Syria without anyone on his side of the aisle batting an eyelash.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Jill Filipovich, what's your rant?
My rant is John Kasich and being tagged as some sort of a great moderate for his recent veto of the 6-week abortion bill in Ohio the same day that he signed a 20-week abortion ban. His excuse for vetoing the 6-week ban was that it was clearly unconstitutional. So is the 20-week ban. Roe v. Wade, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, a series of Supreme Court cases say that you cannot institute a ban on abortion before viability. That is exactly what Kasich has done. It is clearly unconstitutional, and it is a direct path for anti-abortion activists to overturn Roe. And it's time we stopped resenting him as a moderate, especially on this particular issue.
David Frum.
I want to do some real talk on moving the U.S. Embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. The reason that this has never happened before is because Americans were upset that it would destabilize the relationship with Saudi Arabia. The reason it shouldn't happen now is that Israelis should be upset about destabilizing the relationship with Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have emerged as an important Israeli partner. This is something that they do not need that makes their life more difficult. And people concerned about Israel's security should focus on making that relationship more and more real, more and more public, invisible. Moving the embassy makes it harder.
Rich Lowry.
I want to come back to the Electoral College because we have some otherwise very serious people openly calling for the Electoral College to block Donald Trump from becoming president and what would be the most radical, one of the most radical undemocratic acts in American history. And to me, it's just a symptom of the left in this post-election period losing its collective mind, because this would be a more serious violation of American norms than anything we've seen or heard from Donald Trump so far.
For my rant, Facebook has announced a partnership with several news organizations in which they will try to label fake news as being disputed and move it down so it does not show up as prominently in your news feed. I'm watching this with interest. I could see this ending well, making Facebook less of a disinformation engine, making its users better informed. I can also see it ending quite badly with huge disputes over what it means to be fake. We've seen this big problem with fact checkers over the last few years, where media organizations will start these fact checkers and often they will quite usefully debunk factual statements that have clear truth or falsity. And then they often get into expert analysis and say, well, you know, serious people disagree with this idea or this claim is misleading, even though it's technically true, and therefore we rate it as mostly false. If that happens at Facebook, it can end up just further discrediting the idea of the existence of truth, because people will look at it and say, this thing is marked as fake, but it's just because liberals disagree with it that they marked it as fake. So Facebook has to be very careful here. I think it is possible for them to add value with this, but I think it's also possible for this to make the situation even worse. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Jill Filipovich, and David Frum. Laura Dinemillion produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed KCRW.